you were actually a Simpson graduate. And how did you decide to go to Simpson?
Yes, that's very true. I was a Simpson graduate, Jacqueline. I was looking at a lot of music schools, but I discovered Simpson was very special because Sven Lekberg, who was a Swedish-American composer and pianist, was there. And I met him and knew that he could be my mentor and could do wonderful things for me. He and his wife, Mildred, who was a voice teacher, were wonderful mentors and spent a lot of time with me. And I very much credit them with much of my success in many ways.
And after Simpson, then you headed to the University of Michigan?
University of Michigan. I was a piano performance major as an undergraduate, and then I went to Michigan to study with Joseph Brinkman for my graduate studies. I was only there 1 year in residence, though, and then came immediately back to Simpson to teach, where I thought I would spend a couple of years, but it ended up to be a lifetime.
But how did you squeeze your doctorate in then?
Well, that was a little bit later. I taught at Simpson music history and piano and also began a madrigal group, which I still conduct today, and then began the opera program. So I was very much embroiled in those things and spent some time just teaching. But then in the mid-60s, I decided to go to Indiana University for my doctorate in opera conducting. That was after I'd already made one experiment with regional opera, which we call the Des Moines Civic Opera Company.
Tell us, how does a young man from Iowa, you grew up in Walnut?
Yes, Walnut, Iowa.
How does a young man from Walnut, Iowa, get hooked on opera?
Well, that is very interesting, Jacqueline. I did do everything you could do with music and the arts in Walnut, Iowa as a little guy. I was a song and dance man and entertained at church and school and in clubs and so on and so forth. But I also began piano lessons when I was 10. But even before that, when I was about 8, I got hooked on opera. I listened to the Met broadcasts on Saturday afternoon, huddled by the radio in the kitchen, and became great friends with Lucia and Otello and Carmen and Die Walküre and all the great operas. I knew them well and knew the stories and could sit there and imagine how wonderful the sets and costumes were and gloried in the voices and the orchestra. So that was my real beginning. And then I tried to talk my parents into taking me to opera. And there was a San Carlo Opera touring company that was quite popular in the 30s and 40s in American cities. And they toured America. They came to Omaha to Technical High School. And when I was 8, I remember trying to talk my dad into taking me to see some of the operas, but he was no deal. And I tried again the next year when they came, but finally when I was 10, he gave up. And I had cajoled enough, and we went to a matinee performance of Carmen that meant so much to me. The sets and costumes were wonderful, and the singers were just splendid, except for the tenor, who I thought was fat and didn't sing very well. But the Carmen was just splendid. She had to be one of the best singers that ever trod the boards, and I found out years later it was Cole Glade, who was indeed one of America's most important Carmens and sang more performances of the role than any other singer ever, I think. So that was just a splendid experience, and I went to other San Carlo performances through the years and then met performances that came to Des Moines. And so I had quite a little background in opera and just had a tremendous enthusiasm for it from my youngest years.
Well, before we jump in and really get going on the Des Moines Metro Opera, you have also done an amazing amount of things with leadership and training programs. Tell us about some of those types of things that you have done.
Well, I think probably the most important training program that I've had a lot of responsibility for is the apprentice program with the Des Moines Metro Opera. That was part of the original plan with the company, but we weren't really able to make it work until about the third season when we brought in conductors, stage directors, musical directors, to really mount a quality educational program for young singers. I felt the need for such a program in America, and we brought as many as 40 singers to the program and have every year since. It's a wonderful program to give insights into opera disciplines and to give people experience on the stage. We stage a great number of scenes every summer, and then those singers also function as choristers with the opera company. and Compromario roles sometimes.
Well, let's talk about the Des Moines Metro Opera. And you mentioned this other opera company that you had started. And let's talk about how that transitioned then into the Des Moines Metro Opera and how this all got started.
My first venture was the Des Moines Civic Opera Company in 1964 and 1965. I should mention that I really had quite a sophisticated program at Simpson, and it produced some wonderful singers. One of those singers was Carol Stewart, who was a fantastic soprano who had actually graduated with me but remained in the area, and she became sort of prima donna assoluta in those early productions and with the beginnings of the Des Moines Metro Opera as well. And then Robert Goodlow, who had come to Simpson as a public relations man and wanted to sing. He didn't read music, but I worked with him on a variety of repertory and audition material, and he managed to win the Des Moines Metropolitan Auditions in 1964, and then the next year went on to win the National Met Auditions on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. And Bob was a part of the Des Moines Civic venture, too. Carol and Bob were stars in La Traviata that we produced at Hoyt Sherman in 1964. And then in 1965, Bob returned from the Met to do Marcello in La Boheme, and Carol again was Mimi. That was a very successful venture. We had a board and a budget, but I also knew that it probably couldn't continue in the same format. We lost $500 on the Boheme, and that didn't encourage the board very much. So I knew that I'd have to go on to something else, and I waited a while before I did that. I worked on the doctorate at Indiana and then came back to begin the regional opera concept, and that happened in the late 60s and the beginning of the 70s.
And Simpson plays an important part in this. While it's not part of the company itself, it really has become sort of a home for you to host this Des Moines Metro Opera.
It's absolutely true. The opera company could not have existed without Simpson, I mean, in a very real way, because the students formed a major part of it in the beginning. Students built sets for the first seasons, and they acted as choristers and compromario singers. So it was very much of a Simpson-based thing. And besides that, there was the theater. We couldn't do an opera festival until there was the theater where we could perform opera with an orchestra in the pit. And that came about because Simpson was designing a theater, and I was on the committee for the design. So we worked with architect Chick Herbert to produce plans for a theater that we looked at Webster College in St. Louis and the Guthrie Theater. And we also looked at the Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center. Arena-style theaters with something of an extended stage. Chick developed for us an arena-style theater with a proscenium stage and a four stage separated by the orchestra pit, and it was quite a mind-blowing design. But this theater became a home to the opera company because there was no other place, and still is no other place, to perform opera in Des Moines.
Tell us how, then, you decided to get it started and how it happened.
Late in the 60s, I had a cohort in crime, Douglas Duncan, who was a student at Simpson, a tenor, very fine tenor, and also interested in all phases of opera production. And we talked endlessly about trying to develop an opera company. Then he left for graduate school at Philadelphia Musical Academy in a special program in opera in 1972. And that was just about the time I thought it was appropriate to begin the opera company. So we spoke almost every night on the telephone and making special plans for the company and how things could be done, because we had every intention of beginning in the summer of 1973. And so when he came home for the holidays, we visited a friend of ours, Dr. Lawrence Eli, who was a physician and surgeon in Des Moines and whose son, Stephen Eli, had been our lighting designer at Simpson, and he was very excited about our plans and said that he would form a board, and he did, and it was a very high-powered board. He was the president, and Don Easter of the Easter Stores was the vice president, And they worked very hard, and then we had to begin the fundraising business, which was daunting, to say the least. Our first fundraising call was to Hy-Vee, because we'd heard that Dwight Vredenburg was very much interested in music. He was the CEO of Hy-Vee, or the manager, or something of that nature, in Sheraton. Well, that call yielded absolutely nothing, and we knew we had to go elsewhere. We had friends in Clear Lake, John and Doris Salisbury, and we thought we'd talk to them about the proposition. John was the CEO of the Salisbury Laboratories in Charles City, which manufactured poultry medications, and the Madrigal Singers had done a concert in their recital hall. And Mrs. Salisbury, Doris, was tremendously impressed by the group and by the college. So it would just seem rather logical to talk to them about our dreams about an opera company. And so we did, and we made a presentation on that spring afternoon. And John said it sounded pretty crazy to him and picked up his evening paper and went to the porch. But he told Doris she could do what she wanted to do. And Doris said it sounded wild to her, too, but she would give us a chance if we really wanted it and would give us $5,000. Well, $5,000 doesn't sound very much now, but in that time it sounded like we just hung the moon. And so we drove back on two-lane highway through Dowes, Iowa, with an elevator on one side of the road and a bar tavern on the other side. And we went into the tavern and bought a round of beers for the farmers there so that they could toast the new Des Moines Opera Company. Those guys didn't have any idea what we were blabbering about, but they certainly enjoyed the beers. And we went back to Des Moines and we began the real difficult task of bringing a $22,000 budget into focus. It was a daunting task, and that first season was kind of a miracle because it all happened so quickly.
And then did you have a summer season then?
Yes, we had a summer season in 1973. I planned it very carefully so that we would have the possibility of sets for the shows based on things we had done at Simpson, and that we would have singers that were available for the appropriate operas. And besides that, I wanted to bring in critics from outside so we could be accepted as a full-fledged opera company. And so we chose La Rondinée by Puccini, The Swallow, which was almost never done in those days, and a double bill of Prima Donna by Arthur Benjamin, a North American professional premiere of that work, and a double bill with Menotti's The Medium. And then also Benjamin Britten's Albert Herring, a comedy that was scarcely 20 years old. A very unusual repertory, but it did the trick. And we were able to bring critics from Minneapolis and Kansas City papers and Opera News and Musical America. And they all gave us very positive, laudatory reviews. And as a matter of fact, I remember the Opera News review talked about, referring to Rondinée, Swallow, the fledgling opera company that soared to unbelievable heights. And that was the beginning of things, really. And we never received then or since a negative review. So we're thrilled about that.
Let's talk a little bit about you and your role in this, because you have this background in piano. And then also, how does that influence your work? But also, you were the conductor plus the stage director, which is quite rare as well. Tell us how this all helped build the Des Moines Metro Opera.
Being a pianist helped a great deal because I always could embody everything at the keyboard. I dreamed a complete opera from having played through at the keyboard. And, of course, I could coach singers. That's a great advantage. And then realizing an orchestra score at the keyboard was also very important for me in preparing operas. So I always say that the piano is the center of my universe, has been from earliest years. And as far as combining stage direction and musical direction, I did that almost from the very beginning. Well, actually, from the very beginning. When I was a sophomore in college, Mu Phi Epsilon, the professional music sorority, wanted to put on a Mahl and the Night Visitors at Christmas time, and they selected me to do the direction. Well, I think they were selecting me to do the stage direction, but I didn't quite get the idea, so I did it all, musical and stage direction. And that's been the combination ever since. It's always seemed tremendously natural to me. That's unheard of anymore. It used to be done. In the 19th century, there were conductors that also did stage direction, but I think that was in days when stage direction was less elaborate than it is now. But in this situation, we didn't have a situation where the stage director and the musical director disagreed. They were always of one mind. And then I could have musical rehearsals where I could do some dramatic things and staging rehearsals where I could have musical rehearsals right alongside of it. So it seemed very natural. I'm sure some singers came to us that were completely surprised by my doing it all. But nobody ever really complained. Nobody ever complained. So I've always believed that it worked very well, at least for me. When I think back on it, I'm a little amazed that it all happened as well as it did and seemed so natural, but it did.
I can't imagine what your summers were like. I mean, just doing one or the other would be more than enough, but to handle them both, and then you set up this festival season where you have three different performances. And let's talk about the festival season and why you decided to go for the summer festival over the year-round season.
There were two things that gave me that idea. I knew with the Civic Opera, it wasn't enough to just do one performance, one production. And also, there was a company in Kansas City that began in the 50s, in about 1957, with the young conductor Russell Patterson, who organized the Kansas City Lyric Opera and performed in a movie theater and did opera in repertory with young singers from the area and from Chicago and so on. This impressed me tremendously. The productions were not always terrific, but usually they were good. And I went down every fall to see what he was accomplishing. And I knew it was something I wanted to work at, too, eventually. So those were inspirations for its happening. And I always thought that the idea of three operas in repertory could create a real dramatic thrust in the community and could get lots more publicity. And also we could achieve publicity from outside so that critics and audiences could come to us for the weekend and see three different operas. And I think that has worked very, very well for us. Then it's always a matter of finding what operas we should do to balance a season. Our formula was almost from the beginning a standard work like Madame Butterfly or La Traviata, a comedy, if at all possible. There aren't quite enough comedies to go around year after year, but at least a work with small ensembles involved in it. And then a new work, or relatively new work, probably from America or England. And we performed many, many new works over the years.
Now, you also had a goal when you started the Des Moines Metro Opera of developing a national reputation. Why was that so important?
Well, I thought it was important not to just be recognized on the local level. And I thought the local level would be much strengthened by national recognition. I was so concerned about giving a stage to young American artists, and I wanted them to be reviewed and reviewed well. And so we did just that, and we were able to get the critics from national publications, and we were able to have that national recognition, which gave us a great deal of credibility on the local home front as well. The Des Moines Register provided wonderful publicity in the early years and remained very loyal throughout the years, but that wasn't enough. There really had to be a national framework for the whole thing.
And you have continued all the way through your whole career with the Des Moines Metro Opera, getting excellent reviews.
Yes, we've been very fortunate, really very fortunate. I'd like to have a compendium of all the reviews from over the years. I don't have that, but I go back and read some of them, and I'm absolutely astonished.
Tell us about Douglas Duncan. You mentioned him a little bit, but he had quite a personality. Tell us about him.
Well, Doug was bigger than life, that's for sure, in more ways than one. But Doug was an incredible character, and he was an incredible fundraiser. And many, many business moguls said that they dreaded the moment that Doug Duncan called them because he could talk them into almost anything. But he always remained a singer and wanted to be a singer. He finally had to give up the roles that he did with the company because he was so tremendously busy. But he was a mover and a shaker. And, of course, he died suddenly in 1988 of cerebral hemorrhage. And I actually didn't think we could possibly go on. But his right-hand girl, Geralee Mace, took the reins and did a wonderful job as executive director for 18 years after that. Doug was also very much on the moving front of establishing an Opera Iowa troupe, that is a touring group that would function in the winter and spring and tour Iowa and neighboring states, communities, and schools, producing scenes from opera and real operas with sets and costumes, primarily for a young audience. That came to bear his last year, and 1987 was the first year we did the Opera Iowa troupe.
And they're still going strong today.
And they're strong, yes, exactly. They're out and running as we speak.
You had mentioned that you tried to select three different operas every year. How important was that to the success of the company or season?
Oh, I think it was terribly important. People want to see different kinds of things, and we've been able to provide a wide scope of what the operatic stage can offer. I think people enjoy the idea of being able to see an opera like Madame Butterfly that was so well known, and many people would come who had seen it before, but many others who hadn't seen it, and then couple that with an opera like Robert Ward's The Crucible, which was a very, very dynamic, theatrically oriented piece. And it all seemed so remarkable because there was such variety in the repertory and a variety in the singers who were performing it.
Now, back to when you were talking about your friends and yourself who were on the Simpson Committee to help design the Performing Arts Center and this stage— how much of a role do you think that the stage played in the success of the Des Moines Metro Opera?
You know, I think it really plays quite a remarkable role. As I say, I was astonished by this theater when it first came about. So astonished that the first season of the festival, I did all of the productions on the proscenium and put the audience in the forestage. By the second year, I was fully oriented to it and used the fourth stage a great deal, connecting the proscenium stage with the fourth stage with bridges over the pit. And I think that that has been much of our success. You go to the Met or the Chicago Lyric, and you're often a football field away from the whole action. And here you're a second away from the action, because in the fourth stage, the singers are mere feet from you, and the involvement is incredible. There's an intimacy that other opera houses simply do not have. At the same time, there can be a grand panoply on the proscenium stage, and there can be action in both the proscenium stage and the fourth stage at the same time. And the audiences simply love it. People come from a distance because they love the theater and the way opera is produced there.
Tell us what you think over your tenure with the Des Moines Metro Opera, what some of the most memorable productions have been.
That's a big question. Of course, in the early years, I'll never forget the productions in the first two seasons. I'll never forget any production that Carol Stewart did with us. She did operas for the first seven seasons, Manon in Manon of Massenet, Rosalinda in Fledermaus, Violetta in Traviata, Butterfly in Madame Butterfly, and so forth. And she was such a singular actress and singer that it was just remarkable. But I'll never forget the Britain Midsummer Night's Dream we did for television in 1979 with a set, an absolutely magical set built by Dean Cheddar, remarkable set designer, and featuring Jennifer Ringo, who had just also recently been a graduate of Iowa City University and just appeared as a magnificent, transcendent opera star in no time at all. And then there was the challenge of pieces that were really almost too big for us. Wagner's Flying Dutchman, Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov, Strauss's Rosenkavalier, and even Strauss's Zalame, all enormous scores with 70 people in the pit. But somehow we pulled them off in a remarkable way. And then we commissioned an opera from Lee Hoiby in 1986, a version of The Tempest of Shakespeare. And it was a great success, and it was a great challenge as well to put on stage. Singers are associated in my mind so often with productions. Caroline Wisnant, a fabulous dramatic soprano, and Gwendolyn Jones, a remarkable lyric mezzo, as Adelgisa and Norma in Bellini's Norma, a terribly difficult opera that we pulled off in wonderful fashion. And as I mentioned, the Zalame, which Deborah Raymond did for us, a very mature artist that looked like a 15-year-old girl on stage and created an incredible production for us and a Dance of the Seven Veils that no one would ever forget. And then Gwendolyn Jones doing Gloriana, an opera by Benjamin Britten that's seldom performed, but she did it in such a fantastic way. I'll never forget the productions of my last year as artistic director. I was able to do Der Freischütz by Carl Maria von Weber, which I'd wanted to do throughout my career. And it was a wonderful production with terrific singers. And we introduced Brenda Harris as Agata, who later went on to sing Lady Macbeth with us and did the transcendent production of Electra last summer. Then also that same season we did Barber of Seville that was so very special because it involved two Simpson graduates who had gone on to international careers of two different generations, John Osborne, who sang the Alma Viva, and John Michael Moore, who sang the Figaro. There have been so many productions, it's just a little overwhelming, that are very memorable to me.
Well, you did mention some of the memorable singers, but what about some of the personalities? Do you have any stories that you can share about that?
Well, I don't know. Special personalities would certainly involve Carol Stewart and Doug Duncan, who was, as I say, bigger than life, and Ed Bogish, a wonderful bass who was with us for 10 seasons, and lovely Jennifer Ringo, who began her career with us, and a sparkling coloratura soprano. Dean Cheddar was an incredible stage designer who did monstrous sets for our small stage and was just terrific. Stephanie Sundeen, who performed our first Tosca when she was 6 months pregnant, and she also did Ariadne off Naxos and then went on to a career of singing internationally and nationally and is a well-known stage director now. Kim Julian is a baritone who began his whole career with Des Moines Metro Opera as a carpenter and worked backstage for many years and eventually became a well-known regional opera singer and at New York City Opera as well and came back to sing a number of scores with us. I think particularly exciting memory is his Jack Rance in La Fanciulla del West and Caroline Wisnant, who was a fun singer, great dramatic soprano, who now has moved on to German houses, and we miss her very much. She did Fidelia with us, and Norma, and Vanessa, and she had a tattoo on her bosom that we always had to be careful about covering up. And Gwen Jones, wonderful mezzo, who has returned to us a number of times and created the Gloriana in Benjamin Britten's Gloriana. Keith Brumley is our set designer, still at the present time does a lot of sets for us and has for the last decade. Barry Steele is a lighting designer that we enjoy very much. He's done lots of innovative lighting. And I should definitely mention Evelyn De La Rosa, who did a fantastic Lucia in 1992 and has done so many scores for us and is a great audience favorite with us for about 10 years. Does that give you an idea?
I think it does, and I'm wondering how the pregnant Tosca jumped off the wall. How did you
Believe
manage
me,
that?
She did. She did with great aplomb. I had a much harder time trying to talk Senta to jump off the cliff than I did trying to talk Stephanie, who was just a stage animal. She would do what it required.
Tell us, did you ever want to sing? Were you a singer?
Oh, of course I wanted to sing. I wanted to sing in the worst way. The good Lord did not grace me with the greatest of vocal talents, but that didn't stop me. In my freshman year, I did the lead in an opera by Kurt Weill down in the valley. I was Brack Weaver, Brack Weaver is a lumberjack. It was not typecasting. I'm sure there was much imagining that had to be done by me and by audiences, but it was fairly successful. And I did a voice recital every year in college. I thought it was best summed up by Hadley Crawford, who was a voice teacher at Simpson and also the director of the college choir, when he told my voice teacher that Robert was the best singer in school if he only had a voice. And Mildred was very upset by that. I thought it was probably right on the nail head. I can use my voice in coaching very well and have been known to do a Comper Mario role or two. My Dr. Spinalocio and Johnny Siki is pretty famous.
So you are a singer at
heart.
Well,
yes, of sorts. If it can be coupled with drama, I can do it.
You probably deserve the world record for all the productions you have done. Tell us, how many productions have you done while you were the conductor and stage director at the Des Moines Metro Opera?
Well, with the Des Moines Metro Opera Company, I've totaled it a number of different ways, and it always seems to come out differently, but I think it was something like 126 productions with Des Moines Metro Opera. But of course, all that time, I was also doing two and three productions at Simpson during the year as well. So there have been a lot of productions.
To get ready for all these Des Moines Metro Opera Festival seasons, you've had to attend and go to hundreds of auditions. Tell us what that is like, and did you enjoy that process?
Well, I did, and I enjoyed it very much. I love hearing singers. I love hearing singers at all levels of development. We heard singers for both the main stage and for the apprentice program. And in our auditions in Chicago and New York and New Orleans and so forth, we always mixed the two. So we were hearing younger singers and more mature singers at the same time. And I love that balance and listening to the difference in that. I took copious notes always. You had to be able to separate things out, and even drew pictures, particularly of audition outfits that were not particularly appropriate. And I even drew sketches of vocal sounds and so on. But I have always enjoyed the audition process.
Now, part of the Des Moines Metro Opera focus was to provide opportunities for American trained talent. Why did you feel that was so important?
Well, because it was there, because there were singers who were being trained well in programs in universities and colleges and then developing very well as mature artists, but there was literally, back in 1973, no place for them to go. They had to go to Europe to begin careers. There was no place to go in America. The civic opera concept did not allow for that. The civic opera would bring in major stars from the Met or from Europe, perhaps, and then couple them with local singers for choristers and Comper Mario roles, singing in the original language, but a language that nobody understood except those principal singers. And there was no room in that structure of things for the young American singer to be featured or to get really good training. So I thought it was essential for American singers. That was just one of the big goals, to provide another stage for American singers. We were in the vanguard of regional companies that were doing that sort of thing. St. Louis and many other places began just at the same time or just after we began to do this sort of thing.
And also, this is sort of the same philosophy behind your Opera Iowa, where you bring in these young singers.
Yes, well, we bring in the best of young singers to perform a very difficult task of going from school to school and community to community in the winter months to provide quality opera. And we thought it was very important that the kids in the community and the school performances see a full-fledged thing. So a musical person goes to play the piano, and also a lighting and set person goes to set up a real dramatic presentation, very fine, colorful sets and costumes and lighting, so that it's the full package of things. But it was another place where young singers could be used, and we audition in New York and all over for those singers.
Well, then what about like the choruses on your main stage?
Well, the choruses on the main stage are predicated on the apprentice program. So those 40 apprentices who are gaining all sorts of training in classes and coachings and in scene presentation also function as the chorus. So we have one of the best choruses in America, or anywhere for that matter. There are some additional singers with them quite often, but they are the nucleus of the chorus.
Tell us about your interest and support of American opera from the very beginning.
Well, again, because it was there, there were so many interesting composers and scores that needed to be tapped and could be tapped, and special kind of vehicles for young singers that were excellent to exhibit their abilities. America's had such remarkable composers like Robert Ward and Stravinsky, for heaven's sakes, who wrote in the English language, and Carlisle Floyd and Douglas Moore and a host of others. And it was a matter of finding the best of American works to exhibit the best of American talents, an exciting proposition.
Well, what do you think about this year's production of Dead Man Walking?
That's going to be a challenge for us. I mean, it's a big step to do that. That's our first 20th century opera. It's a very dynamic piece, which I have never seen, but I so much look forward to seeing it. Michael Eagle has seen it and thinks it's a terrific piece, and I am just beginning to get to know it myself. But I think it's what we need to do. We need to do the best of the new, and that needs to be included in our repertory.
What do you see as the future for opera in America?
Well, I continue to believe that the future of opera is bright. The quality of productions must be coupled with constant promotion because opera is the most expensive of art forms. When young people come to a grand show, an opera that's done with attention to all phases of the production, they're bound to be captivated by an art form that has held the boards for over 400 years and a form in which all of the various arts come to bear. Opera, I feel, will always have to be a little bit of the museum because there are so many great operas of the past that need to be heard and seen. But it also needs the thrill of the new and even the experimental. My prediction is that opera can flourish in the 21st century if it's managed with flair and innovation.
Do you feel that that's the same thing that the Des Moines Metro Opera needs to do as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think we're well positioned because we have a wonderful artistic director and general director now in Michael Eagle. He's doing fantastic work, and it's just a matter of having the board that has the vision and a director that has the vision to make it all happen and to watch it very carefully. I think it's promotion is key to everything, letting audiences know what they need to enjoy and bringing them in to enjoy it.
I'd like to talk just a little bit about some of the awards you have received and also about how you compiled and edited 7 volumes of an American aria anthology. And still, we're doing all these other things as well. Tell us a little bit about that and how you managed to pull this all off.
Well, I had a lot of help from Rick Walters, who's the editor of Hal Leonard Corporation in Milwaukee. But I did the opera anthologies for G. Schirmer. It was a matter of collecting the finest arias, particularly with young singers in mind, in all vocal categories. It was definitely a labor of love, and then writing about them in the volume. Those opera aria anthologies have become the best-selling anthologies in the world, and they're used all over the world, and I'm very proud of that. I'd like to do more. There may yet be an opportunity to do more of them. And it was something that was very much needed because the opera anthologies were tremendously dated that were available. So every singer who sings opera has those anthologies in their possession.
Tell us about some of the other awards that you have received.
Oh, I don't know. What have I received?
You've got the Governor's Award and
Iowa Arts Award. You know, all those things come as some recognition of what's going on, you know, and what I've achieved, and I'm very grateful that people recognize that.
Is there anything you would like to add that maybe I didn't ask you?
I think it's very important to say, maybe to reiterate, that Simpson was very much a part of the beginnings of the opera company, but somewhere along the line it no longer was important from the standpoint of the organization of the company. We've grown entirely independent of the college, except that the theater that was built in 1971 is the home of the opera company and the only place where opera could be performed in our part of the world. And it's a very special theater, and it remains such. Yes, we wish it were a little larger now, but in the beginning it was good that it was the size it was. Those things are important to be said.
When you look at the Des Moines Metro Opera now, from where it started to where it is now, what are your feelings about it?
Well, my feelings are amazement. When it began, it was the moment that counted, not the future. But if anybody had asked me where it was going to go, I would say it was going to go straight up. But I guess I didn't know that it would ascend to quite the stature that it has. Then it's a matter of maintaining that stature for the future and building on it. And therein is the great challenge. But I know that the company is up to that.
Thank you so much for doing this today. And we really appreciate it so much. And we're looking forward, of course, to the season this summer. I'm sure you are as well. What is your role now as far as...
Well, you know, I'm really an observer more than anything else. I guess I call myself a mentor. I'm there if anybody needs me. And they don't need me that often, but I'm there to be as helpful as I possibly can and enjoy the rehearsal process very, very much, more than I thought I would. I thought when I gave it up, I would just be horrified at having to go back to rehearsals and see what was going on. But I'm not. I'm so inquisitive and so thrilled with the level of things. Last summer's Electra had to be one of the highlights of my life, too. It was really so splendid with the singers that were just so utterly remarkable.
And you did come back to the stage in December for Amal and the
Night. Oh, yes, I did. I directed the Amal and the Night Visitors, which was great fun. Of course, it took me back to the beginnings when I was a student and directing Amal and the Night Visitors. I have no idea how many times I've directed Amal, but it was the first time, I believe, that I've ever directed anything without doing the musical direction at the same time. So it was definitely a discipline.
And a wonderful production. It was very
Yes,
very
I
nice.
Thought so too.
Yes.
Wonderful singers.
Thank you so much. And
it's a pleasure. Pleasure, Jacqueline. Thank you.
And thank you for taking whatever it took to create this marvelous organization and keep it going.
Well, it's been a thrill.
Bravo.
Thanks.